son.
Hi, how are you?
See you.
Which is which?
Either way, whichever you prefer.
Make any difference to me, huh? Well, I'll take the...
Well, you're very good to give me this time.
Well, pleased to do it.
The general idea of this article, Mr. President, it's a 9 or 10 page layout in Fortune. Going to press next week and coming out the day after Labor Day. And it's foreign policy, economic, defense,
right,
comparisons with past presidents. It works. And I thought if you didn't mind, if we could tape the whole thing on the record, anything you want off the record or background, if you'd say
okay,
so, it'll be respected.
All right.
Well, one thing I wanted to go into some, Mr. President, was the interest rates problem. And I've heard Don Regan on the psychology of bond traders and that, but I... beyond that, I worry about whether there's kind of a self-fulfilling quality to the reaction of the money markets in keeping interest rates up, which is going to keep federal borrowing costs up and dampen the recovery.
Well, as I understand, to me, part of the problem is one that I think our economic package will help cure, and that is it's the old law of supply and demand that... We know we're going to show a tremendous deficit at the end of this fiscal year.
Right.
There wasn't anything we could do about that. It was built in. But the money market is aware of that. So they're aware that the government is in there as a competitor in the money market, and there just isn't enough money to go around to meet all the needs. And like anything else, up goes the price they'll pay for it in interest. We're working very closely with Volcker, meet with him regularly.
Sure.
He meets with Don Regan. And we know that as a part of our plan, first of all, there has to be stability in the money market.
Mm-hmm.
We can't go back to the roller coaster of some years past when they've been alternately pulling back the market against inflation or pulling back the money amount for inflation. And then when that brings on business woes and troubles, flooding it with a big surge of money. We've been on a roller coaster. We don't want to go back to that, so we want a consistent policy that will have money growth relative to industrial growth. And as I say, we think that as our economic program begins to work, that the interest rates will come down because of that.
I find the reaction of the stock market more puzzling, actually, than the bond market, because you'd think the your program has such bullish implications in so many ways, even though interest rates are going to be high for the next few months, you'd think people would be buying for the future. And I believe the Dow Jones is lower than when you were inaugurated, which doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, although it also broke 1,000 for the first time in quite some long period since we've been in.
Yes, but it's now lower than when you came in, yes.
Maybe the interest rates have something to do with that, that maybe the bond market is where there's more action than there is in investment. But I also believe that business leaders, the chief executive officers of major corporations and industry, are probably a better indicator than are the people on Broadway, or Broadway, that's Freudian slip, isn't it? Yes, on Wall Street, who are looking to the future and what they try to anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first, we know that that Wall Street was kind of convinced that we'd never be able to get our economic package.
Yeah.
So that pessimism was reflected there. Well, we've gotten it. Now, I think maybe there's some element of, well, is it going to work, or is Congress then going to start nibbling away at the reductions and so forth? But I'd rather go by, the other day, the full-page ad in the papers by one of the major steel corporations that they're going to embark on a $750 million expansion program. This is only one of many. There have been, I think there's a total of about 21 steel companies that have announced what amounts to about $3.5 billion of expansion. There are other indicators from other industries this way. I think as our regulation reform proceeds under George Bush, that we're going to see more optimism out there in the automobile market, which is going to benefit directly from from the change in the regulations. So I guess what I'm saying at great length is I'm not prepared to take Wall Street as a good critic or measuring point for the economic progress program.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is it does have some power to make its predictions come true.
Yes. But if things begin to flourish a little bit, maybe they'll want to climb on.
Well, in your own scenario, Mr. President, at what point would you look for what signs?
Well, I think there's already a beginning psychological effect, one of optimism that you can almost feel out there in the country, and as I've given those other examples of industry and so forth, what they're doing. But, and I think I don't underestimate that. I think that my own study of economics, because that's where I got my degree, not that, not that I was a great scholar or anything, but I've always had a feeling that we've underestimated the psychology, that how much psychology can affect, for example, if there's a wave of pessimism, how many people have to suddenly say, well, let's make the old refrigerator do for another year, or the car, or whatever, and you have a change in the market. But beyond that, I think what is actually going to happen as we pass October 1st, and they suddenly realize that they are paying a little bit less in taxes, and with that, they recognize that the following year they're going to pay even less. There's going to be another cut. Business begins to respond to that. I think money going into savings, the inducements in our program, the incentives to save, are going to create more money in the capital market through these savings. Then I think we're going to begin to see the effect.
You mentioned your degree in economics. I'd be curious in your own economic biography. I don't like the term supply sider, but at what point did you leave the kind of orthodox balance the budget first and then cut taxes approach?
Well, fairly recently, except that for some years, I have been an advocate of cutting the taxes because, as I've said many times, government doesn't tax to get the money it needs. Government always finds a need for the money it gets.
Yeah.
And for we've heard people on both sides of the aisle for the last half century talking about cutting the burden of government and government costs. But always they look down the road and say, "What we, you know, we can't we can't cut taxes until we do this." Well, they never did it. And I, in some of my mashed potato tours back, or circuit tours back through the years, I used to use the example of, instead of waiting for that, I said, if you have a son who's too extravagant, you can lecture him and get no place, or you can cut his allowance and achieve the the same end. And I've always felt that if you take it away from government, they can't spend it. Now, at the federal level, of course, they did that. They, even if they just went ahead and spent it and then borrowed.
Right. Yeah.
And so we've had these years and years of deficit spending. But I then learned when I was governor, when we began giving back the surpluses to the people, and over great objections from the legislature, I might add, suddenly, we found here in California, our inflation rate dropped to below that of the national average. Our unemployment rate dropped to below that. There was an impact on business and industry and prosperity in California simply from allowing the people at the state level to have more of their own money left with them. I've often often told, the biggest difference in philosophy came one day when our surplus amounted at the state level to $850 million. Now I'd given back a surplus of 100, I'd given back a surplus of more than 200. I say, I asked for that, and by making it public, the legislature had to go along. When it came to 850, a senator from the opposite party angrily declared that giving that money back to the people was an unnecessary expenditure of public funds. And I thought our philosophies were pretty well laid out.
But could you imagine, say, 4 or 5 years ago, if you'd been the candidate, proposing a tax cut on this scale without having having only a fraction of it buttoned down in budget cuts on a 3-year?
Well, a few years ago, I had already begun to realize that if you looked at tax cuts, or reductions of the rates, I think is the best way to put it, to make people understand the difference. When you say tax cut, people invariably think of, we are reducing the amount of money the government's going to get. If you talk about a proper across-the-board cut in the tax rate, you find that whenever it's done, even the government gets more money, that the stimulant to prosperity is such that the base is broadened, each individual's paying less taxes, but there are more individuals paying taxes.
Yeah.
And I realize in studying for some of those speeches that I used to make out of the circuit, and I always did my own, that in the Coolidge era, back in the 20s, that was the result of when the Secretary of the Treasury, Mellon, made those cuts. Mm-hmm. It happened with the Kennedy cuts. It certainly has happened just about every time that we've reduced the rates for capital gains. And by the same token, when we increased the rates for capital gains, the receipts didn't go up. They went down.
Right. Yeah. This is the biggest, though, isn't it?
Yes.
And particularly in length of commitment.
But I think we were at a point of turnaround where we had to chart. In other words, it couldn't be cosmetic and just let's cut a few percentage points here or something. Mm-hmm. We had to make the turn we've made, and that involved the turn in government spending also. You stop to think that the savings all in the government spending is going to amount to about $140 billion over the next 3 years.
Right.
That is a definite turnaround.
Yes, it is. As I understand it, the administration, particularly through the Treasury, had been so far this year encouraging the Fed in the tight money policy. But then a couple of weeks ago in some interview, it sounded as if Don Regan was saying maybe we'd had enough of a good thing or something.
No, I don't think that we were really encouraged. We were encouraging the idea that we must have a solid monetary policy where the increase in money supply is geared to the growth and the real need, and not that those extremes of, pull it tight, okay, now we've caused some problems, loosen it, and you cause other problems. I think that Don... what Don was saying was that we can have and should have some loosening of the interest rates because they're now contributing to the inflation we're trying to cure, which I think is the underlying problem for all our troubles.
Yeah. Are you going to say that yourself? Or?
Yes, I'm willing to say it. Yeah. But we can't dictate to the Fed.
No, I understand. On the air controller strikes, or the various mediators and professional labor relations people are speculating that this is a whole turn in the history of unionism in America and so forth. Do you see it in those terms, or?
Well, as an old ex-union president myself, I see it, as maybe the rejection of a turn. For 50 years, the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, encouraged the organization, the unions of public employees. Mm-hmm. But if you will look at that 50-year history, you will find that in every instance, the AFL demanded that public employees put into their constitutions anti-strike clauses. They insisted that you could not, that public employees could not strike against the government. This came all the way from Samuel Gompers, the founder of the AFL. He believed in free unions, in a free country. There has been a turn toward collectivism in recent years. The real change occurred in 1960 when Mike Quill took the transport workers out in New York. And they got away with it.
Yeah.
And the whole thing broke down. But if you look back, Philip Murray, John L. Lewis, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, all at about the same time, all made very definite statements against public employees striking. Because if you stop to think about it, the union leader is representing the employers of public employees. That rank and file working populace out there, they're the bosses. And the earlier position had been that there was no way in a country based on law that public employees could coerce the elected representatives of the people who they had to deal with. They supported the idea of legislation, and labor supported legislation to make sure that there was proper grievance procedure and that there was a similarity in income for similar types of work between public employees and private. But no strike. Now here's a union that had not only that there's a law prohibiting it from striking, but they themselves signed individual oaths.
Yes.
When I took an oath, the oath was to uphold the Constitution of the United States, which means to uphold the laws of the United States. I had no choice in this matter. There was no way that I could ignore the fact that they had broken the law. And that's why I really meant it. And I'm not trying to sound harsh. I'm sure there are a lot of nice people. I think they've been misled, and I think that the things of recent years that have happened have made them not take seriously their oath. But I meant it when I said that really, they didn't strike. Mm-hmm. Under the law, they have quit their jobs.
The little niche that's left for them of arguing that they were intimidated or coerced, that's an awfully hard thing to prove since it's a state of mind. Would they have to produce witnesses or just say I was coerced?
Well, I don't know. I haven't talked to Drew about what evidence, although I understand they are trying to find some ways that where they can generally establish that this might have happened, and then treat each individual case on its merits and what we believe about each case.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one to establish. Would it disturb you if private employers in the private sector treated this as some kind of turning point in how to deal with unions?
Well, yes, it would, because I do believe in the right of employees to strike. I believe in collective bargaining. As a matter of fact, as president of the Guild, I led the first strike the Guild ever had. We weren't happy about it. It wasn't our choice. But in that one instance, the other side absolutely refused to negotiate a certain issue. They would not even discuss it. And we felt it was a very important issue. And finally they had left us no choice. We had to do it. But I've never believed in the right of public employees to strike. And for that same reason, I do believe in doing everything we can to provide the machinery through civil service that will take care of their problems. No, I would hate to see private employers or even let any of them get the idea that there was no right to strike on the part of their employees.
and shift to the Pentagon. And it relates back also to the bond market and the interest rates and Paul Volcker and so forth. How sacrosanct is the 7%? And wouldn't it contribute a lot to public psychology about inflation if people could be convinced that this isn't an open-ended spending situation at the Pentagon?
No, as a matter of fact,
it isn't, but I think
I think it more as a ceiling. In other words, we didn't, in effect, say to the Defense Department, well, now you rush out and make sure that you increase spending by 7%. Yeah. We said we thought that this was something that we could handle in this program that we were doing, and as in fact, it was a kind of a limit, because we do want, and we know the speed with which we have to bring about this change of balance. The imbalance right now has opened what I call a very large window of vulnerability. No, we don't want one thing above all, and that was one of the reasons why Cap Weinberger was my choice for that job, having known him as a finance director in my own administration here in California. We don't want to simply say just spend X amount of dollars for the sake of spending it. Dollars aren't going to, you can't throw those at the enemy if there's an enemy. It was a rate of spending that we thought we could tolerate, at the same time that we are just as insistent, and Cap is working with us on this, that like in any bureaucracy, where we find looseness and extravagance in the military, we want that eliminated too.
Because with, 14.5% coming up in 82, and then about 7.5 next year, 3 sevens on top of that compounded is a lot more than seven. It's
well,
10 or something.
This is one of the things that we've been discussing is, do you start the seven? But there was a surge to get started in 82.
Right.
Well, then do you take that as the starting point or not?
Yeah. I would think that was one of the places where there was some give. But
yeah, we're discussing all these things right now.
Well, amidst so many things needing to be done in defense, what's your own sense of priorities, Mr. President? What's most urgent?
I think, while I don't underestimate the conventional buildup, and we want to go forward with that also, I do believe that the greatest necessity right now is in the strategic area. And here again, at the same time, we're going to start our buildup. I can't say it often enough to the Soviet Union. They want to sit down at a table to discuss arms reductions, strategic arms reductions. We'll be at that table in as quickly as we can get there. And but they must know when they come to the table this time that they have left us no choice. It's either legitimate arms reduction and not some of the phony negotiations of the past where they've continued the biggest military buildup in history while we unilaterally were disarming and getting weaker. They've got to face it that we're not going to sit here in this dangerous position that we're in. We're going to do whatever is necessary to strengthen ourselves. So if they'll join us in achieving the kind of parity that can preserve peace by disarming, fine. If not, we have no other choice but to go forward with the buildup.
On the present military balance, I think I've read everything you've said this year, and I've tried to read almost everything that Haig and Weinberger have said, but I'm a little confused as to whether the position of the administration is that the Soviets have already gained superiority, or we're on the way toward that unless we reversed our course. Or do you feel they're ahead at the moment?
Strategically, yes. Yes, I do. And that's why we've got to go forward with some of our plans.
Right. Overall, including everything strategic, do you?
Well, this is one of the things I can't give you an answer on that we're debating and discussing right now, of all the options open to us, where the priorities should be, how we proceed within the financial limits that are imposed on us. I can't answer that one.
Do you include NATO and the Warsaw countries when you make your judgment as to who's ahead? Or?
Well, there you're talking basically about conventional weapons, battlefield weapons, because the most of them are not, they don't have the strategic weapons. The whole basis of NATO's beginning was supposed to be that we provided the strategic umbrella. Yes. And the Soviet Union is, when they debate, they choose to leave out some pretty important items, like talking, you know, they don't consider the SS-20s strategic. Well, the SS-20s aren't aimed at the United States, but they're aimed at the capital cities of Europe.
Sure.
They don't have to be as long range, but they're certainly not tactical battlefield weapons. And yet they don't want to consider them as strategic weapons.
And the backfire.
The backfire. Right. We have to consider the aging B-52 a strategic weapon, but they don't have to consider the backfire.
Well, you feel the window has already opened, the window
open,
don't it?
Yeah.
How long do you think it's open for?
Well, there is a lag time between order and delivery.
Right.
And deployment. We are looking at all of the options with what can begin to, what can we do that will, in the shortest range, begin to close that window of opportunity while we then look forward to the things that will take longer delivery time. And we haven't made those decisions final or finalized all of them yet.
But it could easily be 5 or 6 years before.
Yes, we think we can get some things online before that. That'd be kind of nervous 5 or 6 years.
How do you see our relations with China unfolding during the window period?
I think that we've convinced the Chinese that we want to carry on this relationship and develop it. I think there are great changes going on there in China also that are making that easier. They obviously are not as doctrinaire in their communism as they seemed to be at first.
No.
You know, it's hard to remember that that was their first argument with the Soviet Union, was that they didn't think the Soviet was doctrinaire enough.
Revisionist.
Yes. But we are going to, we're going to go forward and do what we can with them.
On arms reduction talks with the Soviets, other than a willingness on their part to reduce, do you have any specific policy shifts like Afghanistan or arms shipments to Cuba that are a prerequisite for?
Well, we've made it plain several times to them that we believe that there is a whole area for negotiation, that it shouldn't just be limited to how many missiles each side has, that their performance in the world, their aggressive policy has to be discussed. Are they going to continue that? And if so, we have to prepare to deal with that. And, or are they willing to go forward with their own, on behalf of their own people and their own country, and even maybe join the world in helping the developing nations? I'll be going to the meeting at Cancun, and where there'll be more than 20 nations meeting on the problem of how to help the developing nations become economically viable and self-sustaining, and move up into a better standard of living in comparison to the rest of us. But none of that will be tied to them becoming allied with anyone. And the Soviet Union is, you know, it can't deny its, that its expansion is tied to gaining allies and more to that whole world expansionist mm-hmm. idea.
On the Middle East, Mr. President, having watched it for a long time as a journalist and once briefly inside the government, and having kind of despaired of ever freeing ourselves of the domestic political aspects, but I wonder in the, at your present level of popularity and political strength and with the next presidential election 3 years away, if we can't establish sort of control over our own foreign policy or sovereignty in regard to Israel.
I believe, I want to go forward with carrying forward what started at Camp David and the idea of peace in the Middle East. I think it's absolutely essential to the peace of the world and the free world. And there's no question about our moral obligation and commitment to Israel. Mm-hmm. But if we're to help bring about that peace, we have to establish a credibility with the more reasonable, the more moderate Arab nations.
Yes.
There, so that they recognize that we're not trying to join with one side or the other in achieving an unbalanced or unfair peace.
Right.
And I think we are making some strides
sure.
in that with those states. The manner in which Saudi Arabia was willing to join us after Habib went to Lebanon in trying to arrive at a settlement
right.
there. You stop to think how close they were to pulling the trigger on both sides and
mm-hmm.
what has actually occurred and how it's been held off. Incidentally, I can't give too much credit to Habib. He's
done
a magnificent job. And he would be the first to say now, however, that in this most recent ceasefire that could not have occurred without the help of Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're trying to do, is establish that credibility. And I think we've made some progress.
Mm-hmm.
In it.
Mm-hmm. At your press conference at the ranch the other day, when somebody brought up Haig-Weinberger debates, and you said you like to have your cabinet officers debate
yes.
in front of you, I wondered in terms of foreign policy whether there is some danger, however, of other governments, and even perhaps part of our own government, being confused in the interim before the decision has come, because somehow or other these views do get aired in the papers. And
well, one of the, somebody, many times I've been asked in interviews, were there any surprises? And I've kind of denied that there were, because I was used to there being no secrets in the state capitol
yes.
either. But I think I would have to confess there is some surprise me at the extensive leaks
yeah.
that occur in Washington. You sit in a room, you all feel free to debate and discuss so we can get all the things out on the table. That's the type of cabinet government, incidentally,
right.
let me digress and say that I believe in. This is what we did in California and found it worked. Now, I've had some in government now who have been members of cabinets of the previous administrations. And I've had them say that they have never participated in cabinet meetings that were as substantive
mm-hmm.
as ours are. The cabinet meetings previously were that each cabinet secretary had a compartment, and that was his
yeah.
own turf. And so in a cabinet meeting, he or she would report on their problems and so forth. And everyone else would remain silent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ours is more like a board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And because if you stop and think about it, let's take foreign policy. Yes, that is the prime area of the Secretary of State. But it is certainly tied to national defense. It's tied to commerce. You can go down the line of, there's a little bit of interest
mm-hmm.
from almost every other area. And you've got all those fine minds. And I think we've got a cabinet that's got about as fine a collection of minds as I've seen. So the issues come out on the table, and the debate goes.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone feels free to express the opinions. No. And maybe it's a secretary it isn't his primary interest, but maybe he brings up a facet touching on his department that no one had thought of in arriving at a policy. And what's disturbed me is this constant effort in the leagues to portray it as a kind of turf battle or feud.
Yes.
And it isn't. As a matter of fact, in one of the most recent meetings, Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense were shoulder to shoulder on one side of the way they wanted to go. And the only difference between that and a cabinet meeting is we don't take a vote. I realize when I've heard enough,
the precedent.
I have to make the decision. Yes. And there are many times when I tell them to, okay, time's up, you go home, but we're coming back again on this one because I haven't heard enough to make the decision.
Yeah.
But the it's disturbing to me, and I wish there were more responsibility, not only in those who do the leaking, but those who handle it and without bothering to find out if it's true.
Those who print it?
Yes. The effect that it has on other countries, can't they understand that we've done an awful lot, I think, in these several months to strengthen our relationship with our allies and to give them a confidence that we're not going to throw hasty surprises at them or reversals and so forth, that we're going to consult with them. But then they pick up the press and they read this. And again, as you say, they're confused and they don't know what to believe. How many times that we have to read the paper ourselves or hear the news and then communicate immediately with ambassadors and say, wait a minute, it isn't true. Here's what we're talking about and what we intend to do. And I think this has contributed to some security on their part, that they're not so prone to jump into the first story.
I did a piece last winter for Fortune on the White House and the press, and I mentioned one thing that amazed me during the year I was in there, that at a meeting perhaps of six or seven people, the highest officials, some very sensitive thing being discussed, and then somebody would say, now this is really confidential.
Oh.
Whereas I hadn't naively thought everything was.
Yes, but I tell you, we find ourselves, you know, pleading with each other. Now look, you know, we leave this unresolved issue here. Please don't anyone say anything. I don't know how they happen. I don't know whether it's people who maybe aren't even in the room, but who maybe even have to type up some of the notes or something, or hear something, and with a little bit of knowledge, say something and as fact, and it's only partly fact. It's only that in the nature of, this is what's going on or being discussed. And I find myself just no later than a little while ago facing the press and having to say, we're not hiding from you. We haven't made a decision on this. And then go into a meeting where we talk for another 2 hours on that issue and still haven't made a decision.
Yeah. Is that the only major surprise?
I think so, yes. I am getting more surprised now at how immediate. Well, we've had one in these last few days. The incident in the Mediterranean, and the maneuvers there, preceded by a magazine, national magazine, leak that the magazine would have been hanging out in space had that incident not occurred. And then I even heard a gentleman that I'm sure is very responsible on the news, a retired admiral. And he is taking that leak and accusing us of it being a deliberate leak, that we did it. And then the incident followed, and he's just horrified that this was a kind of a provocation or something. Well, we were horrified by the leak because we made the routine notifications. We didn't want any indication, because there was there was nothing in these maneuvers that was aimed at provoking or running a risk of some kind of incident. There was a recognition that if we went forward with these annual maneuvers, we've done for several years, that because of actions that have been taken by Libya in the last couple of years, firing on a French plane clear out in international waters, threatening some of our own routine patrols and so forth, that they might harass us in some way. And this all had to be considered in whether you were going to go forward with the maneuvers. Well, I don't think the United States could afford not to go forward with them. We couldn't be driven out of doing something that we felt was necessary because of possibility of harassment. And so there was a case in which not only was the leak a damaging thing, but then they made it more damaging by people deciding that maybe we had leaked it deliberately.
Yes, yes. And now Newsweek has a full-page ad this morning bragging about their story and that they're vindicated by the action.
I wonder how they'd feel, though, if some of those some of those gambles resulted in some tragedies.
Yeah.
And
because
you know those Americans could have been shot down, too.
Yeah.
They picked out the wrong planes to shoot at. I found that out when I saw two of them maneuver yesterday out there off the Constellation.
That must have been thrilling.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah.
How do you stand? We need to wind up.
Yeah, we have 5 minutes more.
Sure.
We've got the doctor's waiting. The doctor's group is waiting.
Yeah. All right.
I wanted to try out on you one of my favorite quotations from one of your speeches.
All right.
About sometimes our right hand doesn't know what our far right hand is doing. And I wondered, with Congress coming back, and I keep hearing that some of your far right friends are going to be hotting up the so-called social issues of abortion and so on, how you feel about how you can handle that in relation to economic legislation you want and keeping people's minds on what you see as the top priorities. How much of a problem will that be?
I don't really foresee it as too much of a problem because those things have been there in the mill long before I became president.
Yeah.
And been matters of legislative discussion or attempts at passing legislation. No, we've set priorities and we did stick to that priority of the economic program for these first few months. But it doesn't bother me because I have some rather definite feelings about those social issues also. I do feel that the international scene, that our national security and our domestic economic problems, and you can't separate them, they go together. You can't have a strong national defense out in the world if you don't have a strong economy at home. I think that those are such priorities that we've been justified in spending our effort on those and waiting on the other things, just as I believe that one of our priorities, in addition to making the economic program work now that we have the opportunity, is to come back and deal with what in a sense is part of it, and that is the insolvency of Social Security. And let me make it plain, because here again I have been frustrated by some of the stories. I said during the campaign, and I still hold to this, that we must restore the fiscal integrity, but without endangering the grants going to those people now dependent on them, that they're going to continue to get their checks, and we're not going to whittle them back or anything of that kind. I know that some people took the incident of the minimum situation to think that that was a violation of the pledge. No, what we found since we've been here with the minimum is that there are some people totally undeserving of it. It has been expanded to people who don't have a need for it. But we always tried to make it plain that those people for whom that is an essential part of their income, We intend to take care of that. Now, we may take care of it through supplemental security income, but we're not going to deprive people of real need. But when we find some people with very ample retirement incomes, pensions, such as our public employees, that we're also getting that, we have to question whether that's justified.
When Congress gets back, and if you're able to command the same kind of cooperation from some of the conservative Democrats that you have been doing, does this have some possibility of leading to a new alignment of parties in America? What's the significance?
As an old ex-Democrat who finally found I could no longer follow the leadership of the party, I was quite some years behind Al Smith in discovering that same thing. But I have felt that there has been a shifting, not so much of the people, but of the parties, and that maybe there is an alignment due. We saw that happen in the Republican Party when men like Lindsey and some others have switched parties, but then we saw a Strom Thurmond and a John Connolly the other way. Maybe it is time for some people to look and say, well, where does my philosophy fit? Where can I, let's say an elected officer in government, legislator, congressman, say, well, the things that I want to promote, can I promote them through my own party, or should I change? And, I guess it was all said by Winston Churchill, who changed parties. And Winston Churchill said, some men change principle for party, and some men change party for principle.
Would this, if this begins to spread, does this put you on any kind of spot in the 82 elections as to who you help and who you keep quiet about?
Well, I tell you, I'm already voluntarily put myself in a spot. When those men who were helping, and one of them voiced it and said, he didn't really ask, make a demand. He said, we wonder, though, you got to be out there in 82 trying to get us defeated. And I had to tell him honestly. I said, my own principles, there's no way that I could go in and campaign against any of you after what you've done and the positions that you've taken. How could I stand up and say that some Democrat was unworthy of being in the Congress when he was willing to support everything that I am willing to support?
But then that makes it almost impossible for any Republican to run against him, doesn't it?
Well, that could well be. But then by the same token, I'd like to feel that maybe some of those Democrats are doing some soul searching as to whether they're in the right party.
Yeah.
You know, when one of them admitted to me that I got 72% of the vote in his district.
What did he get?
He got elected. Yeah. I don't know what his percentage 51. Was. Okay. But I had to wonder if he and his constituents might not be in the wrong party.
Mm-hmm. Well, I take it you don't think this administration is just a four-year blip in the...
I sure hope not.
National direction.
No, I feel that with that legislation, we did just about a 180-degree turn in the course of government over the last several decades, and I'd like to feel that it reflects what the people out there are thinking, that they now have recognized we've been on the wrong course, that you can't spend your way and borrow your way to prosperity. And apropos of what we were talking about of parties, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt could be quoted very much about things that he said back in 1932 in that campaign. He said, a government, like a family, in a time of emergency, can borrow to meet a specific need. But a government, like a family, cannot go on borrowing and living beyond its income without coming to a day of reckoning. Well, we've been a long time getting there, but I think this is the day of reckoning.
I've heard you quoted admiring Franklin Roosevelt, also Calvin Coolidge, an interesting are there others?
I was a little surprised by the misunderstanding of my quote of Roosevelt in the Democratic platform at the Republican convention in my acceptance speech, I quoted that my first vote as a Democrat was at a time when the Democratic platform called for a 25% reduction in the cost and size of the federal government, elimination of useless bureaus and agencies, return to states and local governments of authority and autonomy that had been unjustly seized, more individual freedom. And I told it, I thought of it in a kind of a, I put it on this basis that I said to the people, this promise that was made back then in 1932 by the other party, I think it's time that party, that promise was kept. Let's us keep it. And but I think it's an indication of how far the two parties have have changed.
Just one technical question from my article. Is the MX decision and the Mann bomber likely to be announced before Labor Day?
No, I think after I get back after Labor Day. Or
after Labor Day.
Unless it would be in a few hours. Well, I get back before Labor Day, but then go out again, go to New York for Labor Day. And from all that is happening and all the options confronting us, I would be inclined to think it'll be after Labor Day.
So as of September 7th, I can safely say you are thinking about it.
Yes, yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
Well, listen, thank you. I hope I haven't...
it was very thoughtful of you, by the way, to stop in at the Washington Star the last week.
Oh, listen, I did so with a little grief in my heart. You know, just between us here and off the record, is...